Good morning, Memphis, Tennessee. Welcome to Faithfully Memphis. My name is Jay Biedenhorn, and I am the rector at St. John's Episcopal Church here in Memphis, right at the corner of Central and Greer. And I am here today to talk with Christian Mann. He is a Memphian who has native son came home and is making his life here in our city. And we're going to talk here in a little bit about his work and paying attention, about being aware of the world. It promises to be a wonderful conversation. So hang tight with us. You'll hear that coming up. This is the third day of February, and we are in the middle of this long, cold winter, but it won't be this way forever. And I wanted to offer to you today a poem from one of my favorites, a woman named Mary Oliver, who died in 2019. This is her poem, The Summer Day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean, the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who's moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? On the 3rd of February, we also remember Ansgar, who was called the Apostle to the North. He was a Christian bishop who lived in the 9th century, and he was stationed in Hamburg, that international port city in the far north of Germany. If you can't picture it in your mind on the map right now, that's okay. My bet is that there are freight containers here in Memphis being unloaded from rail cars that picked up freight somewhere in a port, New Orleans or Los Angeles, and brought those goods from Hamburg to our city. I appreciate your time today. We got some interesting conversation and plenty more. Stick around. Good morning, Memphis. All right. So I am Jay Biedenhorn, and it is my privilege today to spend a little bit of time talking with Christian Mann, our guest today on Faithfully Memphis. Christian works with an organization called Just Rural Transition. And as I understand it, Christian, you are a native come back to Memphis, right?
Yeah, exactly, Jay. I was not born here, but I grew up here. Spent about 5 years away from here, and as of 2021, am back in Memphis.
Right. And I'm curious. It's got to be an interesting time to make a move. Certainly to move back to a city that you know well. I would be curious to know more about the work that brought you back. What is it that you do, and what is it that Just Rural Transition does?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on, and it's great to be here. You know, we moved to Memphis a year ago in anticipation of the birth of our first child. And it's just great to be back around my parents and my sister and brother-in-law and nieces. And, you know, it's amazing also that in the middle of COVID, I can still do the work that I'm doing remotely over Zoom. So I'm, you know, I'm talking with people all over throughout the day, like a lot of us are virtually. But yeah, the organization I work for is called Just Rural Transition, and we're hosted at Meridian Institute, which is an organization that focuses on problems to development and climate change and environment. Specifically, Just Rural Transition is sort of helping the world think about this broad issue of climate change and what we do about climate change for the food and agriculture sector, which we sort of shorthand as rural. We say just transition because what we're most concerned about is making sure that processes, efforts to decarbonize the agriculture and food sector are fair to people of all stripes and, you know, backgrounds, especially people who are already vulnerable. I'll tell a quick story that just sort of illustrates what I mean by that.
Absolutely.
In the 1980s, there were a number of efforts to close coal plants in the UK because it was, you know, understood that coal plants were polluting the environment. But at the time of these closures, there was actually a lot of pushback from environment from the Labour Party. And what these protesters pointed out was that you can close coal plants, but if you don't have coal workers going to a new job, then you can have a transition, but it won't be just because it will have regressive impacts on people. So you can't achieve environmental goals by paying social costs. You really have to do those together. You have to have a transition for the sake of the environment, climate change, but you also have to make sure that it's just. So that's exactly what we're focused on.
So if I'm hearing you right, Christian, you're saying that the opposition to the plant closure was not environmental in its concern. It was the economic cost to human beings. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of those things that we're holding in tension. You know, of course we need to make transitions to meet the challenges of climate change, but on the other hand, we can't just do it in any way, any old way, I should say. Okay. We have to do it that's fair to people that are vulnerable.
Fascinating. And you said, and that example you use is from the UK. Is your organization, do you work through the Meridian Institute larger, you know, division or whatever your nonprofit's language is your work primarily in the States? Is it global? Where do you do your work?
Just Rural Transition does have a global remit. We're supported by the UK government, and a lot of our work is focused in the EU and in the global South. So countries in Sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, so forth.
Okay, so global South, you're referring to the equator, right? Like, as in
right,
as in,
exactly.
Okay,
yeah,
exactly. Not it. No, because I think probably, you know, maybe okay, right, the developing world. I think. The idea of first and third world countries is more in the, you know, the common lectionary maybe than it once was, and so then just another layer of the onion to think about the global South. Fascinating. Yeah. How does that go on a, you know, on a day-to-day basis? I bet you are like many people like me and spending a lot more time on Zoom and these screens. What does your work look like as you think about justice, those hidden costs, economic costs, human costs? It's all very interesting.
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, we like to say that there are two types of justice at play when it comes to climate change. We talk about fair processes, the way things are done. And then we talk about fair outcomes, what happens as a result of a set of decisions, whether it's policies or in, you know, economic investments or what have you. So when we say just transitions can only be accompanied can only be achieved if we have fair processes and fair outcomes, we basically mean two things. We mean one, decision-making around how to transition has to be inclusive. People that are going to be affected by the effects of a decarbonization policy or what have you have to be in at the table. They have to be in the room. Secondly, the actual impacts of those decisions have to be fair. They can't only benefit the already wealthy and the already politically connected. So with just rural transitions, clearly it's a broad conceptual space, and there's a lot of things one can do to achieve a just rural transition. We're focused on two things in particular, among other things that I think sort of make the conversation a little more concrete. One is helping improve policies, and the other is helping improve investments.
Okay.
So I work on the policy side that's helping to improve agricultural policies.
Okay. Fascinating. Fascinating. It makes sense. If we're going to tackle something as large as climate change and food scarcity, I would imagine there has to be a combination of, multiple prongs of attack, so to speak. I mean, am I imagining that right, Christian, that a policy change would be potentially more of a short-term immediate turnaround and the investment solution would be more of a long-term? Is that right? Do I have those backwards?
I would say both apply to both. You can have a short-term, low-hanging fruit that can be picked from the tree, so you can have quick policy.
Right.
Or you could have long-term ones. Same goes for investments.
Mm-hmm.
This is an interesting fact. Every year, governments spend upwards of $720 billion on their agriculture sectors. They give payments to farmers. They provide different sorts of support to producers along the value chain.
That's most of that money, billions with a B, correct?
Billions with a B.
Got it.
And most of that money does not help achieve climate or environment goals. And so one of our main goals with Just Rural Transition is, hey, how do we take that large sum of money and help bend it towards the goals of a Just Rural Transition?
And if I understand you correctly, it would not be a workable solution from your point of view to say a plant is closed. The solution is to uproot your family 300 miles to a different job market or a different kind of work. That would be displacement, which would, I think, fall below the standards of justice. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm remembering a time a couple of years ago when I was in El Salvador. I was talking with a farmer in a very rural area who told me that because of climate change, the quality of his soils had degraded such that he could no longer make a living from farming. And so he was being forced out of there. And really, what we want to see is decisions around migration, for example, be voluntary, not involuntary. It's fine to move to the capital city, move to the United States, whatever. But so often farmers don't have that choice. They're literally forced out of their homes because climate change has made an agricultural livelihood untenable. So that's the kind of agency, if you like, that we're hoping to return to farmers.
Wow. So yeah, so the a move is not in and of itself a bad thing. It would be unjust to move from a position of vulnerability and no other recourse, right?
Yeah, there's a really interesting Indian economist and philosopher named Amartya Sen, and he said that development is defined as the freedom to choose with respect to things like where you live, what kind of living you make. And I think that's a really beautiful way of talking about justice, returning to people the capability, the freedom to choose what you do to make a life.
Fascinating. That's one of the things that, that way of thinking shouldn't be completely foreign to people of faith. I mean, the idea of the Christian faith, the Episcopal Church in West Tennessee, which we are part of, this podcast is part of, talks about freedom is not so much a restraint as it is the ability to choose to engage with another And to do so, to be motivated from a position of love, right? To think about, we believe that Jesus of Nazareth is the Son of God who chose limit to take on humanness, full humanity, in order to restore. There wasn't any coercion; it was a choice freely made. And it's fascinating to me to think about this in terms of a very real world scenario.
You know, it's funny you say that, because I was at St. John's a couple weeks ago, and I think that was a reading in our liturgy, and I had that very thought, like, what a beautiful description of freedom for a Christian, that it's not total liberation. It's this idea of being committed to one thing.
Yeah, right. I mean, look, freedom is not lack of attachment, right? I mean, freedom is not, there is nothing in the world or no person in the world that has any bearing on me. Freedom is much more about choosing to limit the self for the well-being of the other. If that makes any sense. You know, I mean, Paul, the Apostle Paul, right? He writes about there are many parts of the body. Not everyone is a hand, nor is everyone a foot, but in fact, the other, the hand need the feet to all function as the body of Christ.
Yeah, that's a really potent sort of example that you bring up, because I think with something as complex and sort of diffuse as climate change, frankly, especially for my generation, this idea of limits or restraint or forbearance is quite challenging, not just because my generation doesn't like that sort of thing, but because we're tempted to ask this question, well, what good will it do anyways? If I take a train instead of flying, you know, what difference does one person make overall? But that's, you know, it's that sense of the broader body and its needs, which I think is so critical to actually responding to the crisis that's in front of us right now.
Yeah, you're spot on. I feel like one of the, you know, I hope that I'm a conscientious human being. I hope that I'm considering the well-being of the planet and other people as I make my decisions day to day. But there is a, you know, when you think about something so massive, it's hard sometimes to even feel like you have an entry point into tackling it. And so, you know, I wonder if people who are concerned about this, you know, it's hard not to feel, I don't know, despair or a sense of hopelessness about this, to say, you know, really, if I recycle this laundry container, is it really going to stop carbon emissions? Right. You know, and, I suppose we have to, you know, small drops fill the bucket, as it were. So I know those things are important, but yeah, we're talking about something that is massive. And you know, it's sometimes overwhelming to imagine that our individual decisions, you know, which we are thankfully have freedom to make, there is a hidden cost, right? It's not as easy, you know, garbage just doesn't go away when it goes to the curb and the sanitation workers pick it up. Right. I mean, that kind of thing. It's, your comments about your work, bring to mind for me, the sense of, I don't know, interconnectedness and responsibility that we all have.
Yeah, that's, you know, I love that you brought up the sort of the example of recycling, because, you know, as somebody who recycles, probably every time I do it, I sort of think, well, does this make any difference? It actually makes me think of a question I wanted to ask you.
Sure.
This question of climate activism, or sort of activism in general. I'll tell a quick story to sort of set the question. I was in Glasgow for COP26 negotiations a couple of months ago. And we were inside the blue zone, which is where the formal negotiations took place. And, you know, we're helping make a case for a just rural transition and building policy support for that. But after the events that we had helped organize, I had to walk home to my hotel, and I got sort of pulled in, as one is, into a march where Greta Thunberg was marching. I think day the theme was Indigenous rights. And, you know, it just occurred to me that the difference between people inside the blue zone, the official climate negotiations space, and the people outside of the zone, they both sort of have a role to play. There's a sort of this, you know, almost prophetic role for people like Greta Thunberg to say, we're not doing nearly enough. But on the other hand, the extremely unsexy incremental progress on the inside, that feels important too. And I'm just like wondering for you, how are we as Christians supposed to think about if you buy how I'm framing this,
yeah.
How are we supposed to think about the difference between those two types of action? Because they both seem so important.
Yeah, no, it's a fine question. You know, and just a few things that come to my mind. The first one is, you know, in ancient Israel, it's a theocracy, right? God is sovereign head of Israel, and God speaks and reveals himself through three offices, the priestly office, of which I'm a professional priest in our church, the prophetic office, and also the royal office, the king of Israel. And there is certainly, as you rightly point out, this tension between saying something, doing something, trying to be an agent of positive change in this world. But also, when you get so far out in front of people and hold that prophetic office, there's no doubt that what you're saying is important. There's no doubt that the prophets of Israel were right when they said, we are people of the covenant, and instead we're exploiting people on the margins, the widows and the orphans. So I can appreciate that tension. I mean, you know, one of the wonderful things about the Episcopal Church, of you know, of which I'm a priest, is to think about, you know, this both and, this via media. So I think about that often. And yeah, I don't know. Does any of that resonate with you, Christian? Does that make any sense, that what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I, you know, it occurred to me while I was there that, you know, hey, maybe for my own life, maybe for a season I'll be on the inside, so to speak. And then maybe later I'll be on the outside. One thing I really like about Meridian Institute, this isn't a commercial for Meridian, by the way, but I really just like about Meridian, is that they are really committed to finding a middle road for people who disagree about different issues. I'll tell one quick story.
Absolutely.
To illustrate that. When Meridian first got its start, there was a part of the U.S. government that was doing a lot of polluting. There was trash going into the ocean. I think it was the military. And Greenpeace was really unhappy about this. And they were sort of protesting it, as Greenpeace does. And so Meridian brought these two groups together to mediate the conflict. And it wasn't going very well. So what the folks who started Meridian did was they took this group of people out to an actual vessel. And they showed them, members of the Navy showed Greenpeace, look, there's no room for trash. It's not because we hate the environment. There's just no room to put the trash. But as a result of that process, if I have my facts correct, the Navy developed a trash compaction technology so that they didn't have to throw the trash away. And now that technology is used, I think, widely within the U.S. government. So it's really, to me, it gives me hope that there are people out there who can help groups as disparate as the Navy and Greenpeace find common solutions, because it's hard to imagine we're going to make progress on complex problems like climate change unless we can work with each other. So maybe that involves.
You're spot on. And, you know, I can tell you from experience, no matter your view about climate change or carbon or you know, recycling or any of these things, I can tell you, no matter what you think, it is much easier to hold that view and to vilify the person who does not have the view that you have when you're thinking about that person and their beliefs in the abstract, right? And I think there's something very humanizing, and I think it's something that people of faith are called to do, to actually move towards someone who is different than you, that disagrees with you, and say, to the extent that it's possible. And of course, these are all, you know, these are all pretty, pretty important things that people have strong opinions about, but to move towards someone and say, I want to know more about your view. And here's what I think. When you think about the person that is maybe very different from you as a human being and not your enemy, that changes things. I don't know about you, Christian, but it sort of leads to a softening of my heart, and I'm more willing to hear someone and disagree with someone when I know their name and I know where they're from and I know what they value. And it gives me a lot more understanding of someone, perhaps, you know, as the people impacted with your work with Just Rural Transition. It's not that the average person is really anti-environment. It's they need to make a living to provide for their families and their children. I'm with that. I need to do that too. So it's humanizing.
It's humanizing. I think the environmental movement has done a real disservice by demonizing people who derive a living from the land or from natural resources. Farmers, for example, you know, it's not that large scale farmers are disinterested in the health of their land. Actually, right. They're really concerned with that, but you know, they have a family to feed. So I'm actually reading a book about conflict right now that talks about this tendency to create us and them categories out of
fascinating
situations. And it's just, man, it's such a good reminder that people are so, you know, we contain multitudes. We're all so complicated. And when you get to crack that open and see some of that, you're right. It's so humanizing.
Well, I'm so taken with your work. A couple things I'd like to ask you while I have you. The first one, I'd be curious to know how does one get into doing this work? I would like to know a little more about your background. What makes a guy from Memphis, Tennessee go and get a PhD and is it it's rural sociology, correct? How does that all fit together? So I'm interested to know a bit more about your story and maybe some of the things that you've read or people you've studied with that have been formative to you. And the other thing that I think is worth mentioning, Christian and I were having a conversation before we started to record our conversation. When people look at the Jewish Christian scriptures, right? Both hold the Hebrew scripture and the Old Testament are the same set of books, right? Jewish people and Christian people hold these as sacred scripture. And in the book of Genesis, which talks about the creation of the world, God calling creation out of nothing, simply for the sake of creation, simply to enjoy the company of his creatures. It's like Bob Dylan said, God gave names to all the animals, right? Adam and Eve have dominion. And that word, I think for too long has been used to indicate that we as human beings, we are the end consumer of this economic environmental complex. And I don't think that's what God meant in creation. I think that the idea of dominion is much more about God saying, I'm going back from whence I came, and until I come again, you're in charge, right? Dominion is responsibility. Dominion is ownership. Dominion is living with the care of this creation on all the creatures here, because we're standing in God's place, rather than simply saying more until we're glutted. I'm so taken with that. You know, it's a small but important distinction, right? To think about dominion as responsibility rather than ownership. And you also mentioned, Christian, that the climate change and environmental destruction, or that if you're thinking about dominion as responsibility, maybe a misuse of the creation, these things are all tied together. So, you know, I just throw that all out there. That's a lot. That's sort of a stream of consciousness, but I'd be curious to hear you respond.
Yeah, those are, I really like those questions. I think I can kind of answer them both at the same time. After college, I almost actually went to a school in Chicago to study social justice. Huh. But I then sort of realized, you know, here I am, this white guy from mm-hmm. Memphis. Dr. King's, you know, the place of his, a lot of his work and his finally his assassination. And I decided that it made more sense to come back to Memphis and work for with someone who was not like me, who I could be sort of mentored by. So I came to Memphis and worked for Reverend Marlon Foster, who runs an organization in South Memphis called Knowledge Quest, where he's also a pastor. And we started a community learning effort, and we, you know, we're really proud of our work. We, the first urban farm in Tennessee to be certified organic by the USDA, really high quality produce, but you know, we were really focused on food security for folks.
Pause and brag on that for Memphis, right? Say that say that part again, Christian. That's good news for Memphis. Say that stat or yeah. that fact again.
Greenleaf Learning Farm at Knowledge Quest, which Marlon Foster started and I helped with, was the first certified organic urban farm in Tennessee. And we, you know, I think, you know, agriculture is a really vivid, you know, example of the interdependencies that you were just sort of talking about, mm-hmm. as opposed to having this sort of metaphor or identity of being only a consumer within creation, this idea right. of being a member of an ecosystem. You see that so clearly with gardening or farming. And so I learned a lot about that sort of notion with my own eyes while in Memphis. I eventually went to Penn State and then Washington, D.C. and worked on international issues and you know, over time decided that we'd come back to Memphis. We jointly decided we'd come back to Memphis and start a family here. But, you know, I've done some work domestically and some internationally, but it's, you know, it's always been sort of predicated on the notion that we, you know, we are, like you say, we're responsible for the stewardship of the earth, not necessarily subduing it only, but caring.
Yeah, right.
For it.
I mean, the earth is not an endless buffet. I mean, we have to be more strategic and more, well, and frankly, more just in the way we use resources.
Yeah, well, exactly. You know,
Christian, I don't know if I've ever told you, it's such a, and by the way, Memphis is better for you and your family, moving back and taking up your work here with us. But, you know, I'm married to a woman who grew up here in Memphis, has such a strong pull on its native sons and daughters. It was almost inevitable, you know, Memphians come home, and it's great that you, that you have taken up this important work, here in our city.
Thanks.
Well, so Christian, what else is on your mind today? This is all important. You know, maybe if we could think about it in terms of, I mean, if you were to give the people within earshot of our voices today, some, I don't know, obvious next steps or first steps to be more intentional or a better steward. I mean, you know, this theme that keeps coming up for us, what would you say?
Yeah, that's another good question. You know, and then I want to ask you a question.
Sure.
You know, I think I've been really challenged by, you know, I worked with somebody a couple of years ago who was one of my role models, really. And we tried to get him to come to Washington from, I think he was in Sweden for an event, but he said, I don't fly anymore because of climate change reasons, because, wow. because it accounts for such a large carbon footprint. And I was really challenged by that because he was, you know, this is an internationally known person. And he was, you know, saying that, you know, I'm going to like do something that's very sort of thankless and radical. And so I'm, you know, personally thinking about what are some of those radical things I can do beyond, you know, recycling and being mindful of, you know, of the sustainability of the food that I buy and so on and so forth. I think where we fly and how, you know, how much we fly, that's a really big one that nobody really wants to talk about, honestly. Cause I, you know, as much as the next guy, I like going on trips.
Oh, sure. It's awfully convenient.
I think also, you know, there's this great line from a Rilke poem. He says, I forget how he says it. He says, live the questions. This is one of his notions that questions are things we, you know, live and don't necessarily rush to answers for. But I have this question that's maybe not no easy answers for, but I still wanted to ask it for you, ask it to you.
Sure.
We've been talking about how, you know, if there is this creation ethic, environmental ethic, and it should have a dimension of justice, like we've been talking about, I'm just like mindful that my own life as a Christian has been shaped by the church liturgies that I participate in. And I'm wondering, do you think that, how do you think our liturgies could better or more clearly reflect sort of a focus on the created order on the earth?
That's a fine question. And you know, I take a stab at it. The, you know, one of the secondary but helpful byproducts of this time at St. John's is we have been much more cognizant of our space. And so we have started to have outdoor services when it's not, you know, 25 degrees or 105 degrees. And there's something, you know, really powerful about that rather than hearing the organ and sacred music. You know, look, I'm an Episcopalian. I love that stuff. But for the chorus to be the, you know, the wind blowing through the trees in the courtyard, you know, it connects you in a way that's very local, you know, very centered. There's not another, there's not another place except for the one that I'm in that very moment. And that in a most general sense is what liturgy does for me in general. I mean, to go anywhere in the Anglican communion and I can know where I am because of the liturgy. I'm taken with that. And then, I think that, this is something that the church, probably hasn't fully, come up with helpful responses. I mean, I know in the Episcopal Church, there are, you know, people do these holy hikes and that kind of thing where you go out and you're in the midst of a beautiful wild place, celebrating Eucharist and, you know, that has some potential. I mean, I could, you know, some of my most important religious experiences have happened out in the place and not under a roof with stained glass, though I certainly experience God there too. But, you know, I just feel like the church is I don't know that the church should ever be on the cutting edge, except for in those first, you know, 60 or 80 years after the death of our Lord. But we probably have some work to do in this regard. If I'm telling the truth, I mean, I like the idea of liturgy. I mean, it is the work of the people. We can do better than we've done.
Well, and I think my challenge to myself, you can't see it off screen here, but I've got a stack of field guides for reptiles and birds and stuff. And I think we really protect the things that we love and have named. And I'm trying to get better about naming plants and animals in the forests and fields around Memphis. And I'm, you know, thinking that having a more specific sense of what all is here will also sort of lead me to like a more protective sense of the our part of creation that we live in.
I love that, Christian. I think that is such a helpful point. I'll never forget. I have two children, and when my firstborn was probably less than 2 years old, she was up through the night and had a. She's up through the night. So we're up through the night. And I can remember standing there in my kitchen, making a pot of coffee as the sun was coming up, you know, bleary eyed and exhausted. And I was standing there and it was as if for the first time in my entire life, I noticed those are two different kinds of birds on that power line in my backyard. And I think there's something about being a parent, you know, sort of broke me open in a way and increased my awareness. I love that, that challenge that you've set for yourself, Christian, about being more connected to the place, you know, knowing the names of the plants and animals around you. That to me sounds like the beginning of good stewardship.
Thanks. I'm hopeful it is.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, that I appreciate your time today, and I appreciate you coming back to Memphis. I'm grateful for that strong pull that brought you back, you and your family. And I appreciate your time today, and would wish you all the best and Godspeed in your work with Just Rural Transition, and keep up doing good things. We appreciate you being on today.
Thanks, Jay. It was great to talk with you.
Absolutely. Take care. Well, dear listener, our time has just about come to an end. So I wanted to tell you that I appreciate your time today. And I wanted to tell you that this is Faithfully Memphis. You can find us here at 8 o'clock every Thursday morning on WYXR. Don't forget to check out the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee. We have a pretty active social media presence on Facebook, Instagram, and also catch us on our website, episwtn.org. That's the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee. You can also catch past episodes of Faithfully Memphis on Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcast. So like and subscribe and help us tell the stories of good things happening here in our city. This is Jay Biedenhorn for Faithfully Memphis. Until next time, stay safe and stay positive.